I'd like to say good morning to all, of course, and I hope everyone is safe during these trying times, and hello to Mr. Orozco. I want to start off by saying and getting right to the point that without a doubt, at least in our eyes, appellant was denied due process and a fair trial and substantial rights to present a defense in this matter. I have a couple issues that I would like to specifically address. I'm not going to address every single issue that we alluded to in our moving papers, but I want to focus on two primary issues right now, please. Number one is, which I find very interesting, and I hope you guys do or everyone does, is the issue pertaining to the not allowing the limiting jury instruction regarding the acquittal of Mr. Dredd in his first trial. As we all know now, Mr. Dredd had a first trial where he was acquitted of two of the three counts, the conspiracy charge and falsifying an official document, which I believe is the whole issue in this case, his February 26, 2011 incident report, and how that relates to the hung jury count in count three with lying or obstructing justice with the FBI. He was acquitted of the first two counts. Why is that relevant? That is relevant because the transcripts of the second trial and the motion in limine rulings are very crystal clear that the government's whole theory and attack was the fact that Mr. Dredd lied in his first incident report. That was his only report that he tendered regarding this incident. Interesting to note that Mr. Dredd, a deputy sheriff, with no prior history, no prior problems. Interesting, he wrote his report first and without in any way collusion with any of the other deputies who were charged and tried and eventually convicted, including Sergeant Gonzalez. But most importantly about that issue is the whole thrust of the second trial. And one must ask, what is the difference? What was the difference between the first and the second trial? Well, twofold, and these are our two main arguments. Number one being that once requested and other conduct, relevant conduct or not, was introduced with respect to a 404 ruling by the district judge, then absolutely, absolutely without a doubt, the acquittal jury limiting instruction should have been tendered. What did the district judge rely on? The district judge relied on the Norgren case. With all due respect to that case, and I'm not trying to say it's not binding, that was the 1950 case, 70 years ago. That case ruled, and without getting into it, had to do with two things, illegal fishing and bribery of a warden or state officer. With respect to that issue, I could understand the difference between the Norgren ruling and the Dredd case. They're totally different. One can think they were not illegally fishing and also still believe if there is a problem, going to try to bribe an official. The two are not matched together. That is different than Mr. Dredd's case, the appellant's case. In the appellant case, everything alluded to in the second trial had to do with the fact of his false report in the first trial. That is unequivocal. There is no doubt about that. All of the issues with Sergeant Gonzalez and any lies or deceptions to the FBI or anything alluded to, and interesting to note, the actual incident report was introduced as an exhibit. So everything related to that February of 2011 incident report. But now the government is trying to say, well, we can get it into based on relevant conduct, but a limited jury instruction is not appropriate. Interesting to note that with respect to, and I wrote this down, and I'm looking down on page 43 of the government's moving papers, the second to last paragraph, last sentence, it says those decisions, and they're citing their laws of other district courts, because the Norgren case seems to be the only case on point as to this issue. So they're citing to other district courts, which is fine, and I'm not arguing about that issue, but if you read their last sentence, those decisions unanimously hold that an acquittal may not ordinarily be introduced to suggest innocence. Right there, they acknowledge, the government, that there is room and possibilities to, in fact, allow a limited jury instruction based on acquittal evidence or facts. Right there, their own language. In addition, with respect to the Viserto case with the V, it's interesting because I wrote it down. That says acquittal evidence is not usually admissible. Exactly similar to the wording that I just cited from the government brief. So both issues that I just brought up clearly announce that acquittal evidence in certain proper circumstances can be alluded to and referenced by the district judge, especially just like in the case law cited by everyone in our moving briefs collectively, with when the evidence is introduced, the court has a responsibility and duty, the district judge, of course, to tell and inform the jury about the limiting fact. In addition, at closing time during jury instructions, to again mention this important and critical fact. Everything about this case, I'm a trial lawyer, everything about this case had to do with, did he lie? Did he lie? Did he lie? And in this case, it all goes back to the exact issue that I've mentioned about the fact about his initial and only incident report. It is crystal clear that was the government's whole theory. So again, what changed between the two trials? One, the jury never was able to receive the most important and substantive fact that he was acquitted of the exact conduct that the government relied on. I can't think of anything more unfair in a trial. It's truly upsetting. But besides that fact and trying to be so demonstrative about it, the next issue is whether or not, and now I'm going to transition into the second main point that we have, is the rule under Federal Rules of Evidence 610 and the toll records and the communications between Sergeant Gonzalez and Mr. Dredd appellant. Interesting to note about this, that was not the issue in the first trial. In the second trial, the government, for the first time, subpoenaed these toll records and had two separate FBI agents testify about the contents. They had an exhibit which had the toll records, the text, the communications, phone calls, everything on a whole big chart that was introduced as an exhibit. But when Mr. Dredd testified to explain the content of these particular communications between himself and Sergeant Gonzalez, he was unable about the critical point of the conversations. So, under Rule 610 of the Evidence Code, it's interesting. Evidence of beliefs and opinions regarding religion are normally inadmissible. That's not what happened here. Again, the district court, in our opinion, committed reversible error and misjudgment by ruling, and I think her line was, religion has no proper place here. Well, that has nothing to do with that rule. That rule has nothing to do with explaining the communications and the content of the texts and phone calls between the sergeant and Ms. Sheriff Deputy Dredd. And that's the difference. We are not arguing, or appellant is not arguing, that we want to introduce religion into the trial to bolster his credibility. His credibility was bolstered by his background, his family, and everything else that he has done in his life up to that trial, both the first trial and the second trial. He comes from a wonderful family. His mother was a clerk for a district judge. His father was a sheriff deputy who had high ranking. And so he comes from a good family. That was the credibility issue and the character witnesses. It had nothing to do with religion.
On the point, the government says, I know the district court didn't rule on it, but that it was hearsay. And I think you respond to the brief that it's admissible under Rule 801. Can you explain that further? I wasn't sure if I fully understood that argument.
Yes, thank you. First of all, we will submit that obviously there should be deference, but in the totality of circumstances, the court, any court, could take judicial notice of a fact that happened in a trial. So we do not believe that it's hearsay. We believe that it's relevant to provide the jury with the true foundation of what's happening during the proceedings and the substantive arguments by the defense at that time and the merits, especially when the government keeps on relating back to the relevant conduct issue and the reason why they believe it's admissible. So we believe that there is no hearsay issue or rule. And interesting to note, and I'm not trying to say this is binding in any way, because I expected that question in state court. I practiced in state court too. There's law right on point that allows this exact type of evidence when the government seeks to introduce evidence of issues or conduct that somebody's already been acquitted. There's no hearsay. It's admissible. I just wanted to throw that in there because I thought that was important. But I understand the issue that the government says in their one or two sentences that, hey, no matter what, it's still hearsay. We're not offering it with respect to a hearsay argument. We're offering it as to judicial notice, and the district judge absolutely has the right to inform jurors about not only an acquittal, and that's why, by the way, in other cases that this issue has arisen, besides the case I cited, Norgren, and the other districts, obviously those cases that have the issue have gotten by the issue of hearsay. Those cases have ruled that it's interesting to me that what they have found is not really attacking the issue of the limited jury instruction. What they have found is the fact that the due process rights of the defendant at the time of the trial were not violated. So in combination, it's crystal clear that Mr. Dredd did not receive a fair trial. And this argument would be different if this was the verdict after the first trial. It wasn't. So something materially changed, and his substantial rights were definitely violated. And it's very troubling. There are a couple other issues, such as, you mentioned, Your Honor.
Excuse, suppose he had been, it seemed to me that that testimony would not have made a difference.
What testimony?
The testimony about the content of the conversation. He testified in general.
Correct. And I think it was.
And so he would have said, what we really talked about was matters relating to our mutual interest in religion. I can't believe that that would have affected the verdict.
I understand that argument. It was a little cut off, Your Honor, but I believe I understand what you were saying. I understand that Mr. Dredd was allowed to testify to subject matters of what their conversations entailed in certain circumstances that had nothing to do with religion. I agree with Your Honor. However, the main content and what was disallowed was that subject matter because, frankly speaking, and I always try to have credibility myself, not always, I do, is when you're a juror and you see charts and you hear evidence about two grown men having 3,000 phone calls, maybe 4,000 texts, you might wonder, wait a second, that seems to be a huge amount of communications that most people probably do not, develop. But that's the other issue with respect to allowing, which was objected to, these toll records that went from 2010 to 2015 instead of the critical time period of February 2011 to July of 2012, the FBI interview. So again, not only was the district judge wrong in not allowing the content. Now, I agree. If you take that issue exclusively, I would agree with Your Honor that that point alone does not connotate, I'm going to find someone guilty or not guilty. But in combination with everything else we have articulated in our moving papers, and I just wanted to say one thing about hearsay. How come the district judge allowed the hearsay reports of the other testifying deputies when clearly they testified? The report should not have been admitted. So I see I'm running out of time only, I mean almost, and I'd like to reserve a little time that I believe I have. So I will submit on that. And if there's any specific question, of course, I'm here to respond. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flair.
You're welcome.
The way this courtroom clock works, when your time's up, starts to run upwards. So that's overtime.
Okay.
So you just about were exactly on the money on your time. So although your time for rebuttal was consumed, I'm going to give you an extra 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
So if, before you sit down, if Judge Corman or Judge Lee have questions now, they could pose it.
I ask you about your acquittal argument. There's a Supreme Court case called the Ash versus Swenson, which is a kind of collateral estoppel argument, which says that if a jury acquitted on charge A and decided certain facts that are necessary to charge B, the government can't go ahead with charge B. You're not making that argument here, are you?
And that's a great point. That's why I did not allude today in my two main arguments about the constructive amendment argument that we also alluded to in our moving papers. I wanted to move on from that. So Your Honor is correct about that. That's not the main thrust of our argument, of course.
Are you arguing it at all? I didn't notice.
I mean, with all due respect, I had a problem with the constructive amendment because I'm trying to merge that with the collateral estoppel issue. But I know that this matter was sent up to the Ninth Circuit for the interlocutory appeal. And, of course, reading everything about that, I understood that. So I'm not limiting the Ash matter. I'm just going back to the main thrust that in this particular matter is the great example of the exception of when acquittal evidence should be introduced in the limiting jury instruction. And the fact that the Norgren case that everyone has relied upon, especially in the Ninth Circuit, and the district judge in this case, that case is, that, you know, I don't want to use the word archaic, because I don't want to be disrespectful to the age of 70, but at the same time, I think we need some fresh ruling on this specific issue, and I think this is the text case for that to be implored upon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flair.
You're welcome.
We'll give you 2 minutes in rebuttal, so now we'll proceed to the government's argument. Mr. Roscoe.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Agustino Roscoe for the United States. I'm going to begin by addressing the defendant's argument with respect to the district court's ruling limiting his testimony about religious conversations with Sergeant Gonzalez. The district court did not abuse its discretion in limiting this testimony under Federal Rule of Evidence 403. The probative value of this testimony was low in that it didn't go directly to an element of the offense. And on the other hand, the danger of unfair prejudice was high because the testimony about these religious conversations would appeal to the jurors of religious beliefs, whether they agreed with the defendant's religious beliefs or not, and posed a potential for the jurors making an improper decision in the trial. Now, the record in this case demonstrates that defendant repeatedly tried throughout trial to use religion to boost his credibility. Defense counsel argued that he was a church-going man and that the jury should consider his character, and that's at GR 876. His pastor testified about his character, and that's at GR 763. In addition, the defendant himself testified about his own values, that he has good morals, and that he was a descendant of preachers and teachers. That's at GR 618. In addition, when defendant was talking about his educational background, he said he was getting an MBA at Biola, but went on to explain that Biola is the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, and that he really wanted to study theology. That's at GR 625. And so defendant tried to testify further about his religious beliefs in his communications with Gonzalez. He managed to testify that defendant and Gonzalez had a Bible study together, and that the Bible was his source of strength. That's at GR 676 to 77. Now, by looking at the way the questions were asked and the way defendant answered, the record demonstrates that defendant was simply trying to appeal to the jurors' religious beliefs in doing so. Defendant testified first that in July 2012 he was relieved from the sheriff's department, and then the very next question is, how did your relationship change? Referring to his relationship with Sergeant Gonzalez, to which defendant responded, he asked me what my source of strength was, and I told him, to which the government objected. The very next question after that was, so did you start hanging out more, or did you start talking more? And he said, we started having Bible studies because the gospel is my source of strength. So defendant repeatedly was trying to interject not the contents of the conversations, but that the Bible was his source of strength. And in any event, there was no respect to defendant's constitutional argument. No defense was actually excluded. Defendant was allowed to testify that these conversations with Gonzalez had nothing to do with the Carrillo incident. In fact, he did testify that the conversations had nothing to do with the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department at all. And that's at GR 679. And then defendant testified at length about his relationship with Gonzalez. He testified that it started off as a professional relationship, that it evolved into a mentor-mentee relationship, and that eventually blossomed into a full friendship. And that's at GR 676. He testified that he spoke with Gonzalez when Gonzalez's home was searched in December of 2013. That's at GR 680. And he testified that he had a girlfriend at the time that was friends with the Gonzalez family, and that his relationship with Sergeant Gonzalez continued in 2015, coincidentally about a month before Sergeant Gonzalez's trial for this very incident. And that's at GR 680-84. But more importantly, that was not defendant's main defense at trial. Defendant's main defense at trial...
Wouldn't it at least provide some context to the number of conversations with Sergeant Gonzalez that they were talking about religion? You know, people a lot of times rely on religion during times of distress. So wouldn't that give at least some context of why the number of communications increased during the time that he was under investigation?
And so the government's not arguing that they're not without any relevance. The government concedes that they're at least minimally relevant. But what the government is arguing is that this court did not abuse its discretion in finding that the prejudicial value, that those communications were unfairly prejudicial when weighed against the limited value that those statements provided to the jury.
If you were trying to testify saying, you know, I would never lie because it's against my religion, I would agree with you. But just to allow one question, one answer to say the context of the discussions were about religion and how I cope. I don't see how that's prejudicial in any way. In fact, to leave the jurors with the impression that they were quote-unquote about personal matters kind of cast doubt on his credibility. You know, I mean, what were they talking about? You know, about the, you know, Yankees? I mean, during the time that he was under investigation, I think raises some doubts about the credibility of his testimony. So it seems like the judge should have allowed maybe one question, one answer with respect to what the content was, and don't let Mr. Grantham try to gild the lily or you know, go over the top about it, but you know, at least provide some context.
And he did provide context, Your Honor. He testified that yeah, he had Bible studies with Sergeant Gonzalez, but the defendant took it a step further and said that his Bible was his source of strength, which is clearly appealing to the juror's sensitivities with respect to religion. And defendant was allowed to testify at length about his relationship with Sergeant Gonzalez and how that relationship had nothing to do with the Carrillo incident and how these communications had nothing to do with the Carrillo incident. And in any event, that wasn't even his main defense at trial. Defendant's main defense at trial was that he was mistaken about what happened in the break room in February of 2011, and he was misled by Sergeant Gonzalez to believing his statements to the FBI were true at the time he gave it to them. And he testified extensively about that, and that's at GER 632 to 650. Defendant even put on expert testimony by an expert on memory who testified that Sergeant Gonzalez's aggressive questioning could have planted these thoughts into defendant's head. So in terms of defendant putting on a defense, he put on his main defense at trial, not only through his own testimony, but through the testimony of this expert witness. And even if the court did err, any error was harmless, as Judge Corman pointed out, there was extensive evidence in this case that defendant lied to the FBI during his July 2012 interview. And the key evidence is the stark contrast between what defendant told the FBI on that day and what actually happened in that break room. Defendant told the FBI during his July 2012 interview that he remembered seeing Gabriel Carrillo, that he saw Gabriel Carrillo swing at a deputy and try to push past the deputy to try to escape the break room, that he saw Gabriel Carrillo punch Deputy Luviano in the chest, and that he saw Gabriel Carrillo punch Deputy Luviano with his right arm. And that false narrative about Gabriel Carrillo being the aggressor in that break room that day, was a narrative that was consistent across all of the false reports by all the deputies who were working to conceal the beating of Gabriel Carrillo. In fact, it was consistent with his own report that noted the punch to get to Luviano's chest and noted the attempt to escape the break room. And his report is at ER 737. And that is in stark contrast, that false narrative of Carrillo being the aggressor is in stark contrast to the testimony of Gabriel Carrillo himself and the two cooperating deputies who testified that Carrillo was handcuffed throughout the entire assault, that Carrillo never tried to push past a deputy, that Carrillo never swung at a deputy, that Carrillo never tried to escape the break room, that Carrillo never punched Deputy Luviano in the chest, and that Carrillo didn't punch anybody with his right arm. It was simply impossible because he was handcuffed and getting beaten and pepper sprayed and beaten again on the floor of that break room. And that's corroborated by the photograph of Gabriel Carrillo after the fact and the photograph of his wrist showing that they were both swollen and bruised from being handcuffed throughout the assault.
How do you account for his acquittal, his prior acquittal?
Your Honor, we can only speculate as to what led to the first jury's decision. All we know is that the evidence presented in this case and the jury only took about an hour to convict in this case. And so that demonstrates that the evidence in the second trial was overwhelming with respect to his guilt, with respect to his lies to the FBI in July of 2012.
Do you agree that the evidence in this case was similar, if not identical, to the evidence on the charges that he was acquitted?
Yes, Your Honor. The evidence in this case was similar to the evidence presented in the first trial where the two acquittals came down.
Similar, was it identical?
The changes were made to the second trial, but to say that they're identical and sort of apples and apples is not necessarily probably true, but it is very similar to what happened in the first trial.
So I could not hear Judge Corman's last comment.
I asked whether it was identical or just simply similar, I believe.
Okay, thank you.
And how do you distinguish this case then from Ash versus Swenson?
Your Honor, prior to this second trial, the defendant did take up the issue of collateral estoppel up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit did decide during that interlocutory appeal that the defendant could be retried with respect to this third count, the third count of the charges under 1001 for his lies to the FBI. So that issue has been litigated and decided. With respect to defendant's arguments that the acquittals in the first trial should be admitted, that's been decisively decided by this court in Nordgren. This court held in Nordgren that evidence of an acquittal is simply without value because you don't know what considerations the first jury took in making its decision in the first trial, and it would only serve to confuse the jury. Defendant doesn't raise any issues in his papers or any reason in his papers or any reasons now as to why Nordgren needs to be revisited or why a carve-out should be created for this case. In fact, defendant doesn't cite any law from any circuit which allows evidence of an acquittal to come in. What is decided is that under Rule 404B, acquittal evidence, so evidence in the previous trial, is admissible, and what's not admissible is the evidence of the acquittal itself, and that's conclusively decided in Nordgren. And And that rule makes sense because an acquittal is not a finding of fact. It's more prejudicial than probative, and it's hearsay. So you can't take judicial notice of an acquittal as defense counsel would think the court could do because it's simply just not a fact. It's something that happened in the previous trial, but we can only speculate as to what the considerations were with respect to that acquittal in that case. Defendant tries to differentiate Norgren by saying it was totally different. It's the exact same issue that happened here. Defendant was acquitted on a different charge in a previous case. The exact same evidence came in through the testimony of the same witness, and the court ruled that the evidence of the acquittal did not come in despite the fact that testimony from the first trial again came in the second trial. So with respect to Norgren, there's no reason to revisit Norgren. Norgren is good law. In fact, all the circuits point to the decision that previous acquittal simply doesn't come in the subsequent trial. And there's no basis to revisit that decision or to create a carve-out under the circumstances in this case. And with that, if the court has no further question, I will yield my time.
Yeah, I have no question, but let me ask to Judge Corman or Judge Lee if either of you have questions. Okay. Hearing none, we'll proceed to Mr. Flyer, to whom we've given an extra 2 minutes of argument.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you. You know, with all due respect to the government, I was a prosecutor. They missed the point of the argument. They mentioned just now to this panel that about a conspiracy, about falsifying a report. They mentioned to the exact issues, as they always have, as to the conduct that he was acquitted to. And as Judge Corman correctly pointed out, this trial was identical to the first trial. So what is the difference? The only difference I could see is the toll record chart. So it is identical. So what is the difference? The difference is, do you allow the substantive right of a defendant, a deputy sheriff, to present a defense, i.e. the limiting jury instruction, versus the toll records? That's the only issue I see. So with respect to the Ash matter that has been alluded to, there's no language in that case that says anything about Norgren and or a limited jury instruction. The government cannot have it both ways. They cannot say we're going to allude to a false report and a conspiracy, but not allow the defendant his substantive right to introduce the acquittal evidence as that evidence is being introduced. And as Judge Lee correctly points out, we are not arguing that religion should come in on all trials. But in this case, this isolated case, when you have all of these texts, all of these phone calls, one or two questions about the content of a majority of the calls should have been allowed, and that content deals directly with religion. And as Judge Lee points out, I'm sure they were not talking, because I'm in Los Angeles, about the Dodgers losing last night. So I don't understand how they can have it both ways. He did not get a fair trial, and it's upsetting, because what's the difference from the first trial and the second? Well, I'll tell you, the district judge's rulings that were unfair. And in combination, we have shown this is not harmless error. This is prejudicial error. And I will submit on that unless there's other specific questions that I could answer.
Thank you, counsel.
You're welcome.
I'm afraid you're over the extra time.
I understand.
Very much appreciated your argument.
Thank you.
However, if there's any question from any of the other judges, we'll go further. But I have one question myself. The government argued that there was an interlocutory appeal, which it felt dealt with the Ash v. Swenson issue and said we had ruled this trial could proceed. So how do you respond to that?
That question to me, Your Honor?
To you, yes.
Yes. That has nothing to do with the issue. The issue of proceeding, I accept the ruling by, of course, your circuit, the Ninth Circuit, and what happened in the interlocutory appeal. But that has nothing to do with the issue of Norgren, which I believe is way outdated law, and certain exceptions that can be shown if appropriate on an ad hoc basis. The fact that the trial was allowed to commence as to count three and there was no collateral estoppel, I'll even throw in res judicata, it doesn't matter. That has nothing to do with the issue of giving notice to a jury of the acquittal evidence based on a limited jury instruction that is totally fair and was proper to do. How can a jury rely on information of relevant conduct, which was the predicate of the whole case,
counsel, and not allowed? With my question, I've taken you way over your time, so
I understand.
Unless my colleagues have questions, we'll submit this case. Okay, hearing none, the Dredd case shall now be submitted, and parties will hear from us in due course. So I think before we proceed to Del Rio, I think I would like to take a 10-minute break now, but we have two more cases after that break, which will require an hour of argument.